Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is David Schaeffer, the author of Antonin Artaud, and the book was published by Reaction Books and the University of Chicago Press in 2016. Hi there, David.
Hi, Roxane. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. Would you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France and French history?
Okay, well, presently I'm the chair of the history department at California State University, Long Beach. I'm also a professor of modern and contemporary European history. So how did I get into French history? Well, let's see. First of all, I was not a history major in college. I was a political science major and a sociology minor. And I went to law school after that. Mm-hmm. And when I was about, I think I was just about to complete my second year of law school and was trying to scout around for something else because I knew I did not want to be a lawyer, though I would complete law school. What I did was started thinking about my interests. My principal interests were film and a class I had actually in French political theory as part of my political science major that I found to be really interesting. So what I did was, as I was scouting around for my next move after law school, I just decided to settle on French history, and I applied to do my doctorate at University College London under Douglas Johnson, and I got accepted. What got me into French history is probably not the most typical path. I don't know. I guess I was drawn to it because of the macabre aspects of French history, and I was always really embarrassed by that. And at one of my first seminars as a grad student, I always try to find a higher level of why I got into French history rather than, you know, talking about, you know, heads on pikes and heads falling into baskets. But in any event, though, Douglas Johnson at this first seminar was introducing, I guess, whoever was giving the talk that night and said, this person got into French history the way many of us do through the macabre aspects. And I knew I was with kindred spirit at that point.
That's terrific. And what brought you to the work and life of Artaud in particular?
Yeah, so my first book was on the Paris Commune of 1871, and my doctoral dissertation was on the revolutionary tradition in France from L'Etoile Glorieuse up till the defeat of the Commune. And I've always wondered, like, you know, why does the revolutionary tradition that I identified in my doctoral thesis come to an end? And I've always been fascinated with Artaud, and I can get into that in a little bit as well. But one thing that I found was a continuation with my prior work in reading Artaud, where I saw Artaud as a revolutionary. And I felt that the obliteration of the Commune ended a particular type of revolutionary tradition in France that had existed since the French Revolution of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. But that couldn't continue, could not be sustained. In other words, the idea that power was for the taking in the street, political power, for example. And what Artaud represents to me is the conquest of the cultural space rather than the political. And I see him as a revolutionary in that way.
So, David, obviously we're going to be spending the next hour or so talking about Artaud, but could you just give us a sort of brief mini biography of him before we get into it, just so we can kind of situate him as a figure?
Sure. So Antonin Artaud, he's from Marseille. He was, I guess, I don't know, a thumbnail sketch of him. He was a poet. He was a writer. Theater theoretician, actor, matinee idol, in fact. he was considered to be one of the most in the 1920s in one French film magazine. I think they ranked him like one of the eight top heartthrobs in France. he was a good-looking guy. And then what he's increasingly identified with is his drug usage, and that's what draws a lot of people to Artaud. I was once at a used bookstore in Rouen where I used to teach, and I asked the guy if he had any – when I first started the project, if he had – and he works on Artaud, and he says, no, they're really hard to maintain. They're hard to keep here because, he said, young people keep coming in here to buy it. And I thought, wow, there's that much interest in Artaud. And he said, yeah, there is because of the drugs. They want to read about his experience with drugs.
Right.
So there's that. And then, of course, he's identified with the 56 electric shock treatments that he got at the asylum in Rodez in the south of France, you know. And so that's basically, I mean, he's a guy who is known for – not really known for any great plays that he wrote. He's known for having been in some of the greatest movies of the French silent era as an actor, but he's really known a lot for his ideas. Theater of Cruelty, for example.
Yeah. And I'm going to want us to bring us back to that in a little bit, but before we get into the biography in any detail, I guess I want to ask you, David, about what you see as your principal interventions with respect to the world of Aalto scholarship, other biographies. Why write this biography? Why did you feel like you needed to write a biography of Aalto?
Yeah, well, initially I was not going to write a biography of Aalto. I was going to contextualize Aalto a bit more than I feel I really did in this book. And what happened was I had sent a précis of, chapter by chapter précis to a few publishers, including the publisher of my book on the Commune. And basically what I got, from publishers that deal with, in a variety of disciplines is, well, we sent it to the theater people and they thought it was too historical. And the history people thought it was too much cultural studies and too much theater. So we don't really know how we'd pitch this thing. So, thanks, but, we're going to pass on it. So, I still felt that I wanted to work on Aalto, because no historians have ever worked on him, number one. And I find him to be a fascinating individual. In some respects, I felt a certain identity with him personally. And I know that, we typically tell our students, don't get too close to your subject. And I always told that to my students, for example, don't choose a topic to work on that you feel too close, because the distance between you and your topic won't be great enough for you to have an objective enough perspective. But, I guess I disabused myself of the idea that any of us are ever objective about anything we work on, number one. And so consequently, I didn't really worry so much about that. And, I felt that whatever closeness I felt to Aalto, however much I shared his sensibility in some respects, and not all, trust me. So I was freaking out by that. Yeah, I thought that. My God, your next call is going to be basically a 911 call. But anyway, But again, as a historian, I wanted to put him into a certain. I wanted to put him into his times for sure. I wanted to show that whatever sort of aversion historians have had, and this is absolutely true, that very few historians, even those who write cultural histories of 20th century France, never reference Aalto, or just do it very obliquely, but never really interact with him. And I felt that that's a shame, that this is a guy whose own connections were with some of the leading figures of his time and some of the, most important movements. And we can really tease out a lot about the history of that period through his life.
So what about the experience of doing biography as a researcher and a writer, David? You say at one point in the introduction to the book that, and I'm quoting you here, to study Aalto means respecting the impenetrability of his seemingly Kevlar-shrouded head. So what was it like for you to do a biography, and what were some of the specific challenges of doing this biography?
Yeah, Aalto is a very obtuse individual, and I think he purposely made himself like that. I don't think that he wanted people to really understand him perfectly clearly. And yet I think that that's what a number of biographies have endeavored to do in the past, primarily ones, the many that have been written about him in France, in particular, have really tried to speak for Aalto. And I don't think that that's possible. It's not that it's not the right thing to do. It's just not possible really to do so. His writings are pretty much all over the map in many ways. There's not a consistency in them. And to try to find a consistency in them is to play a fool's game. I think in that introduction, if I'm not mistaken, again, it's been a while since I've reread the book, but I quoted Jean Baudrillard, who basically said that everybody has to have their own personal experience with Aalto, rather than to expect that it's kind of a one-size-fits-all and this can be the definitive biography of Aalto. There have been people who've tried to do that recently, in fact, and there have been others who have respected it. But I think that that's what my approach was, is to respect him and not to try to speak for him, to try to present his writings, to try to find some sort of logic in them. And that can be a really trying thing to do. And at the same time, to situate them in the period in which he lived.
Well, let's start where you do then, with his sort of family background and family relationships and these bourgeois origins. What does the book offer us in terms of where Aalto comes from and his family dynamics that help us to understand his subsequent life?
Bourgeois family from Marseille, family that was fairly prosperous at one time and then fell upon hard times during his youth. So there was that, a very stifling home environment, as bourgeois families in France were prone to be at that time, particularly because they're always prone to be, but particularly at that time. He didn't have a an especially close relationship with his father. And so that, in many respects, determined his approach to authority, overall. He had kind of a weird family background where his grandmothers were sisters who were separated at birth. And, you know, one thing that you may or may not ask me about is, where I got some of my material from, at least the images that I use in the book. I developed a pretty close relationship with Aalto's last surviving relative. This is his 86-year-old nephew, Serge Molosena, and Serge's wife, Simone. And I've gotten to know them quite well. Anybody who really works on Aalto and wants to get access at the BNF to the Fond Aalto has to go through Serge. Now, in my case, Serge invited me to come down to Marseille, to Nice, excuse me, where they lived most of the year at that time, to see him. And, you know, my daughter lives in Paris, and so she and I flew down to Nice, and we thought it was only going to be a few hours. And, you know, 12 hours later, you know, we were basically begging them to call a taxi for us. But the thing is that was just the start of what became a pretty good relationship right there. But one thing that Serge's wife, Simone, told me is that why the family comes to an end, and that is that, I guess based on the grandmothers and whatnot, there's a feeling in the family that insanity might be congenital. And so people in the family decided not to perpetuate the line. And when Serge passes, that'll be the end of the Aalto family right there. Huh. So the thing is that, you know, his background might have had a pretty big effect on who he became, you know, in France, in literature and theater and, basically in terms of, you know, the gestation of his ideas.
And his childhood was really clouded by sickness and death. I mean, it seems to feature really centrally as well.
Yeah. He had a case of meningitis, or at least we think he had a case of meningitis. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. I mean, diagnoses of meningitis, were not quite as precise in that day. He was very sick. We know that much. He had a younger sister who died at a very early age, and this had a pretty profound effect on the family. And there was a pretty big gap between he and his younger brother, Fernand, as well. There were these instances in his childhood, for sure. Other things, though, that were less dramatic and less painful than that, though, were his trips to Smyrna, which is now Izmir in Turkey, to visit his, you know, one of his grandparents, his grandmother who stayed in Smyrna. The other one was transported to Marseille with an uncle and never came back. That was the separation of birth business. But his trips there gave him an appreciation, I think, for other cultures and really situated him in terms of his frames of reference in the, you know, the Mediterranean writ large, you know, coming from Marseille and then traveling a couple of times in his life to Smyrna, where, you know, which was a formative experience in his life.
I want to follow up on that a little bit, David, just because I guess what little I knew about Aalto before reading the book, I guess I didn't really have a sense of where he came from and what his sort of cultural origins were. And really throughout the book, I mean, we don't have time to talk about every single place he resided in all those moves, but you know, you do make the point early on that the space of the Mediterranean is really important. Then, of course, there's Paris. So his moves within France are important. But then he travels to numerous other places, including, you know, Ireland and Mexico. And then there's, of course, the places and spaces that he imagines and draws on for inspiration in his work, particularly, you know, the East. So I wondered if you could just comment on the role of place and space in his life and in the book.
Yeah, sure. Marseille at that time was, you know, one of the few very multicultural cities in Paris during his youth. You know, even at that time, it was being, you know, just across from Morocco and Algeria. So it had a pretty rich cultural life, which Aalto was familiar with. And then, of course, there were his travels to Smyrna as well. And Smyrna itself was a multicultural city before, you know, it all kind of, you know, went to hell in 1922 with, you know, the war between Greeks and the Turks there. So in terms of place, Aalto basically, and this is where I see him as part of, and this is going to be an answer to your previous question that I didn't really get to, which was his resentment of his bourgeois background, his resentment of Western cultural references. Now, I don't know if his travels actually created that resentment towards the West, or whether he resented the privileging of Western cultural values and reference points And that's why he reacted so strongly. And as you said, yeah, in his mind, he'd never been to Bali, for example. He had never been to Cambodia, where mm-hmm. he'd seen, you know, Cambodian dancers at in Marseille at the Colonial Exposition. And then 1931, he experiences Balinese theater. And so, you know, he never really, he never went to those places, but in his head, I think he felt that he had, and he got some of that stuff wrong, but he was so committed to challenging and transforming Western values that it was as if in his mind, I suppose, that he had been there, or he had come from another place and another mm-hmm. space. And as you probably read in his writings, I mean, you know, kind of weird things about what his origins were and where he came from and where he had been in past lives and, you mm-hmm. know, all of these things. And, you know, I wouldn't say that he actually believed those things. But, you know, again, it was to distance himself from his own space, the space that he occupied.
I love that moment in the, it's really early on. I think it's either in the first chapter or in the introduction where you talk about his sort of refusal of his birth date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that when you said earlier that you try to kind of go with him while writing this biography, that for me really stands out as a moment where you're kind of honoring his way, to say that there's a biography. And of course we have these dates that we would delimit his life using these dates, but that he had this kind of more imaginative or creative or performative sense of his life as extending beyond that human temporality or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Performative is the operative word there. You know, his performance was it, you know, and I struggled with whether Artaud was really performing life or whether, you know, where he saw life as a stage and an extension of the stage that he acted on,
mm-hmm.
or whether this was just the way he navigated, whether he felt everybody else was a performer and he was the genuine article.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think it was the latter, actually, that he was striving for an authenticity that he felt was missing from the world and especially from the West. And again, you know, he was such an idealized Orientalist because that's what he was. I mean, he was an Orientalist but one who idealized it, you know, in a way that others saw it as exotic. Artaud didn't really see it as exotic. He just saw it as real. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, I tried to respect his views, his perspective, his writings, his approach as much as I could. I didn't want to ridicule it mm-hmm. as a lot of people have done in the past.
So just to kind of follow up on this idea of the West and the non-West, mm-hmm. as I was reading the book, I was thinking about the biography in relationship to, I don't know, the last couple of decades of work in French history and French studies on empire. And do you feel like the biography was sort of influenced by that historiography?
Well, if I did it, I didn't necessarily do it consciously, although I am familiar with the works that have come out. So perhaps it was, you know, somewhere in the recesses of my consciousness mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that I was thinking about these things, that, you know, the more recent, as you say, the more recent historiography on the end of French Empire, French colonialism, the critique of it, perhaps that did influence my reading of Artaud in a way that I saw him as someone who was really rubbing against the grain in that respect during mm-hmm. his, you know, the time that he lived, you know, as he dies before the end of French colonialism. And when there wasn't really within France a particularly strong movement against colonialism.
I want to ask you, David, about other ways in which the book strives to place Artaud's life and work in historical context. So you've already signaled the idea of thinking about his life in relationship to a French revolutionary tradition. But mm-hmm. there are these other things that make appearances throughout the book, you know, a kind of story of modern technology, culture, and politics, major historical events like the World Wars. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about how you're moving back and forth in the book between Artaud's life and the more big ticket history of politics and culture in France and beyond.
Yeah, big ticket items. Where do I start? Let me start with the First World War, for example.
Sure.
And, you know, Artaud's experiences, he was conscripted. He either contrived sleepwalking, but somehow got out of his military service and was sent, you know, to his first stint in an asylum because of that. So there was that. Yet I think there was a certain amount of guilt that he felt for not having really experienced the First World War, not having experienced any action. Mm-hmm. And I think that came through. And I think I mentioned that later on. He was in a film about Verdun, mm-hmm. which was, and in that one, You know, he plays a guy who is killed in the war. And, you know, for him, if I recall, he tapped into, was it, and I'm sorry, I'm going to really probably flub this. But I don't know if it was André, I think it was André Masson, the artist who remembered laying on the battlefield in a, you know, in a prostrate position, basically. And, that Otto in the same film, in this film, Verdun, he adopts the same pose, having heard that from Masson. Maybe that was his way of trying to form an identification with what soldiers went through. But in any event, I always wondered as I was reading his, whatever kind of references he made to the war and whatever kind of connection there was later in life, whether he did feel a sense of guilt where so many had perished in the war. He didn't, and he had a relatively easy time and, you know, a certain sense of guilt over that. So there's that. Okay. To start. Second of all, there was his work with the Surrealists, and you know, the Surrealists was a major artistic movement, but also a political movement. And, you know, part of his break with the Surrealists came when the Surrealists affiliated with the Communist Party. And it's not as though Artaud was a reactionary. And there's been a book fairly recently by a theater scholar about Artaud, which basically paints him as a proto-fascist, which I do disagree with. But the thing is that his break with the Surrealists over communism wasn't so much because he was opposed to communism per se, but because he felt that the whole idea of a revolution of the proletariat that lay behind it was just going to lead to yet another form of class domination and a restriction on freedom, which he was opposed to. And he felt surrealism was opposed to as well. So there was that. Let's see, what else could I talk about with respect to him? Well, of course, there was the impact of the Second World War in his life. Hey, he was really, really lucky in many respects that he was institutionalized during the Second World War. Because on the one hand, yeah, he could have been executed for having been in an asylum. But at the same time, as an artist whose views were really pretty much out of the box, he was vulnerable to that. This is a point that Sylvère Lautréger had made actually in a brief essay about Artaud, about his vulnerability during the war. And, you know, maybe he was at the end of the day lucky to have been institutionalized. So there was that. In terms of technology as an actor, you know, he is a silent film star and, well, star, I guess, of sorts. But, you know, he was in, you know, he was in Apelganz's Napoleon. He played Marat, and he was in Carl Theodor Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc. And the sound comes along, the talkies come along, and that's all the rage, of course, you know, at the end of the 1920s. And Artaud rejects it because he feels that that film has more potential as a visual medium, and that it's destroyed by the introduction of sound.
Would it make sense, David, to think of Artaud as a kind of anarchist politically, or no?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it's worthwhile to think of the Surrealists as anarchists until they affiliated for a relatively brief time with the Communist Party, that they were anarchists. Look, I'm working on a new project now, which is a murder case in 1923. It was Germaine Berton, and she was an anarchist, or you know, hung out in anarchist circles in any event, and she killed Marius Bateau, who was the secretary of the Action Française. She wanted to kill Léon Daudet, but he wasn't at the headquarters. Now, she became a cause célèbre for the Surrealists, and in one of the editions of La Révolution Surréaliste, they have a picture of all the Surrealists, you know, on the border of the image on the cover, including Artaud, and in the center there's a big photo of Germaine Berton. So the thing is that I think that for a while the Surrealists saw themselves as anarchists who were above and beyond any political parties or factions in France, and just embracing this whole idea of complete freedom. And Artaud never lost that, and that's why he. That's why ultimately he broke with the, or he felt that the Surrealists broke with him, I guess is the way he would probably say it.
So I feel sort of base asking this question, but what about his love life? What do we know about that part of his life? You know, you tell the story at one point in the book about of one great relationship. It's not the central thread by any means of the biography. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So his relationship was with, her name was, Atanasio was her last name. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on her first name, started with a G. But anyway, Zhenitsa. Atanasio. I don't know if I'm giving that a Yugoslavian pronunciation with the ch, with the C, but it's either, she was Romanian. It's either Jenica or Jenica Atanasio. And she was an actress, and he had this kind of torrid relationship with her. A lot of it expressed through letters. And the letters can be, you know, very tender at times, where he makes these great protestations of his love for her. And then they can just be absolutely diabolically mean-spirited in the next minute. Now, a lot of the problems that they had to do with his drug usage. And she was having a hard time dealing with that. So, you know, he would write letters sometimes saying, oh, yeah, I'm not taking laudanum, I'm not taking opiates. But then he would write back saying, oh, I was just prescribed another dose of morphine and it's really helping me a lot. And, you know, then radio silence, I think, from her for a while based on his next letter to her. Mm-hmm. So in terms of his love life, well, this is the thing that I think has probably bedeviled anybody who's ever studied Arto is, did he die a virgin? And I don't know if that's what you were asking.
Oh, not in particular, but, no.
But I guess that's something
I didn't
that
even realize that was a thing.
Well, I mean, it might have been. I mean, we don't know. I mean, and, you know, his relationship with women. Yeah, he had what could have been platonic relationships with them. He had some where he had one where he almost married, or he wanted to marry this one woman. And, you know, he was so, she was from Belgium, or Lessem Schramm, and Cécile Schramm, and, you know, he went up to see her family and they were quite bourgeois, and he totally, like, you know, totally freaked out her family, and they pretty much called off the whole thing. But, you know, I don't know if he ever consummated a relationship. I don't know how deeply he connected with women. It's a very, very difficult question to answer. Mm-hmm. Because there isn't a lot other than the letters with Jenica or Jenica, and then the other ones that he, and then the kind of circumstantial evidence that we have regarding other relationships that he had with about three or four other women.
Let's, I'm sort of proud to have gotten this far in the interview without talking about the drugs full on, but let's focus on that for a while. I mean, it's certainly, if you know anything, you think theater, drugs. So what new information, insight does this biography give us with respect to Otto's drug use, addiction, if we want to call it that? I know he didn't want to call it that. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the one thing I did not want to do when I wrote this book was to really focus on the drug usage, because I know that that's the thing that attracts a lot of people to Otto, and I didn't want that to be what defines him, as it too often does.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is, you can't avoid it. Okay. And in not avoiding it, I felt maybe I discussed it more than I really wanted to. So with respect to the drugs, I mean, he's originally prescribed it because of, you know, various ailments, whether it be physical ailments, whether it be mental ailments at the time. You know, this was fairly common practice. And then he developed a dependency on it. And, you know, was it an addiction? Yeah, probably was, because he couldn't stay too far away from it, even though he wanted to get away from it. On the other hand, he also wrote essays in which he, you know, complimented others who had talked about the mind expanding properties of drugs. And he saw that as something that, you know, gives it a bad rap, that it has a bad rap, but that actually, as an artist, it can be something that can, you know, expand one's consciousness and, allow one to think more deeply and to see things that one doesn't ordinarily see. He did write about that. For the most part, he would say that he took drugs because he needed it, because he felt he was sick and he was in pain. Mm-hmm. And drugs relieved the pain that he was in. So there was that. When he went to Mexico, he was going to the Sierras to see commune with the Tarahumara in just outside of Chihuahua. The Tarahumara are a native tribe of Mexico that, again, that eschews any kind of contact with the West. They're known for being great distance runners, for example, but yet for a long time refused to participate on the Mexican Olympic team because they didn't want any association with what they saw as a Western country. Mm-hmm. So Otto, they have the peyote ritual that they engage in. And I'm not saying that that was the reason that attracted Otto to go to stay with the Tarahumara, but while he was on his way there, he wrote about how he threw away his last tabs of heroin, because that's a Western drug and he's now going to experience something that's non-Western. So even in terms of his substances of choice, he was trying to get away from Western references.
Well, I guess in a related I mean, all these things are interrelated, but just to sort of ask about the way in which this biography is a kind of history of Artaud's mental health, but also of the management or treatment of mental health and of psychology and even psychoanalysis. I guess I want to just ask, you know, how much that story of how these things change over the decades of his life matters to his biography in particular. And then maybe as a kind of subset of this question, the role of psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. both for him, how important mm-hmm. those ideas were to him, but also to you as a writer thinking about Artaud as a psychological phenomenon, how much this book approaches or has to deal with the idea of a kind of a psychohistory of this figure.
Yeah, that's one of the more controversial aspects of Artaud's life. The mm-hmm. if we can work backwards from the electric shocks, you know, obviously for quite a long time, electroshock therapy or electroconvulsive therapy, as it's known, was out of favorites. Believe it or not, now make it a big comeback. But at that time, it was reasonably controversial. And, you know, when Artaud was being given the 56 treatments at Rodez, you know, the doctor Ferdier, who administered them, really believed that this was something that was going to cure him, that this guy was really suffering. And he was. When he was transferred from Paris, from the Villers-Bras asylum, which is just outside of Paris, down to Rodez, you know, he was in almost a catatonic state. Mm. And so he's given the treatments, and he claimed that his, you know, his spine had broken at one point, and or his spine had fractured, and I don't know, I think it was something about his teeth, and he was always constantly in pain. And I believe that. I'm sure that was true. But having said that, though, and when I started writing the book, I really thought that this poor guy suffered miserably, and he suffered, you know, this horrible experimental treatment at the time. But, you know, there's no mistaking that his writing was a lot more lucid. It was a lot more focused when he got out of Rodez than when he entered. He pretty much stopped writing for years when he'd been in asylums. And then he gets out of Rodez, and some of his best writings are produced that time, including the English title is For an End to the Judgment of God, which I think is a brilliant essay, very prescient. And his essay about Van Gogh and Van Gogh suicided by the society, where he draws parallels between himself and Van Gogh. So I'm not at the point where I'm going to say that he was actually helped by electric shock treatment. I'm not certainly going to be an advocate for that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I really can't condemn it in terms of as something that was really disastrous for him. In terms of his other treatments, you know, his first sustained treatment was under the care of a Dr. Toulouse in Paris. And Dr. Toulouse was a guy who really felt that really substantial artists all suffer from some sort of a malady that causes them to see the world differently. And he adopted Artaud as one of these people that he saw throughout, especially French history, as French cultural history, as one who suffered, but through that individual suffering could produce really profound and sublime works of art.
I guess I want to ask you, David, about the arc of his work over the course of this life, partly because we can't talk about all of the work, but, you know, across the biography, if you had to do it in sort of broad strokes, what are some of the big things you'd say about how his work changes as he matures? Or
I don't know if it matures or if it just changes. I don't know if it really evolves. In the 1920s, when he's with the Surrealists, his writings are a bit more social and political. By the 1930s, he's really focusing on theater. He's focusing on theater as film and theater as agents for change, that you can really transform society. And that's where I see him as the revolutionary, as the guy who's really trying to transform what he sees as bourgeois hegemony, and knows that he's not going to be able to launch a revolution in the conventional sense of the word. But feels he really feels he can do it through theater. He feels he can do it, that it can be done through film. You know, he writes about the Marx Brothers, for example, who he loved. And Marx Brothers movies, yeah, believe it or not, he went to see it.
It's not really surprising.
No, it's not. But the thing is that what he saw in it all was the kind of zaniness of it, and the craziness, and the way in which they totally upend the way the world is experienced. Mm-hmm. And he felt that that was the future of, if done properly, film and theater. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he didn't feel it was actually done right. But he focused a lot on that. Mm-hmm. Later on, and I guess there is sort of an evolution or some sort of an arc, I guess, actually, to his work. Because later on, when he gets out of Rodez, his writings do take on a more political tone. This one, For an End to the Judgment of God, for example, very, very prescient in terms of how it you know, anticipates the Cold War. And, you know, he's writing this in 1946 and nuclear weaponry and how that could lead to the annihilation of civilization and especially competition between the Russians and the Americans. He also writes about genetically modified foods, you know, before that was really an issue, you know, talking about that and how in America they're growing things that, you know, can't be grown and in sizes that are, you know, unknown and so on and so forth. So, you know, these are the major things that he writes about, you know, in addition, of course, to the things that I've already talked about, his, you know, his antipathy towards the West and his privileging of the East, mm-hmm. of Eastern value and Eastern culture.
We've already sort of talked about a number of ways in which you tried to avoid, and I think you do avoid, getting sucked into mythologizing him in a negative way and caricaturing him with respect to drug use or mental illness or some of these other things. So what about the scandals? I mean, I feel like when we talk about the relationship between performance and life in the case of someone like Artaud, the centrality of provocation and the drama of his actual life, and then some of the more scandalous aspects of his work and his performances, you inevitably have to deal with those things. But how do you do that without getting sucked into the caricatures?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to do, actually. In his own life, it's a question of how much influence he actually really had. Mm-hmm. You know, how much notoriety he had. And I really wasn't able to find that there was an awful lot to it, that he was on anybody's radar necessarily. I mean, artists knew about him. Mm-hmm. He tried to scandalize theater as much as he could with his performances. You know, whether there was something I mentioned in the book about a play that was done at one of the theaters that he was working with, that he was actually a director of, the Théâtre Alfred Jarry. And he talks about Paul Claudel, I think calls him an asshole or something along that line, that this was written by Paul Claudel, who was a, you know, Catholic, you know, very Catholic. And I think Artaud made some reference to that as a way to scandalize the audience. Mm-hmm. And then he had another play, one of Strindberg's plays that he did, and he got a big burstment from the Swedish embassy. And then he insulted the Swedes as well, not by saying anything negative about Strindberg, but basically saying how Strindberg found all these people who were here useless, who were in the audience, would have found them to be useless. So he did things like that. But outside of that, he really didn't do that much that scandalized. Even his one movie that he wrote, The Clergyman in the Seashell, which is one that's considered to be by many the first real surrealist film. It's quite a short movie. Mm-hmm. Even that didn't really get much play, and wasn't really that well known at the time, other than the fact that in England it was banned. But that was it. But in France, it didn't get an awful lot of a lot of notoriety at the time. A lot of what happened with Artaud in the popular imagination happened subsequent to his death.
Mm-hmm. It's true that I think of that film as sort of, you know, central. I certainly had to watch it several times in college and had to. I shouldn't say it like that. Got to watch it several times in college. And,
well, I mean, even with that, though, you know, it wasn't for want of trying that he was, you know, endeavoring to scandalize audiences and, you know, give himself a little bit of publicity. You know, when that was screened, there was a disturbance in the theater because he claimed that the director, Germain Dulac, mm-hmm. Dulac was, you know, totally misrepresented the screenplay that he had written, and mm-hmm. you know, had her own vision and turned something that he had written into a very straight narrative. Now, you said you've seen it, and you know that there's no straight narrative to that movie. And the question is that, you know, I mean, you know, did he really believe that, or was he trying to use this as an opportunity to create, you know, to start a fight in the theater?
A happening.
And then, yeah, exactly, a happening, and then basically he would get the press for it. And he did get something for that.
Right. So let's talk about the notion that maybe people who know Aalto's ideas and particularly his work in theater probably know best, which is this notion of cruelty, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did Aalto mean by cruelty, and how are you working with the manifestos that he wrote on the subject of the theater of cruelty and the way that that idea runs throughout the project, the Aalto project?
Okay, one thing, first of all, about you mentioned the manifesto, and I find it extremely ironic that Aalto used a manifesto, because this was a guy who felt that the words are a contrivance.
Hmm.
And that they break pure thought, which is what he was endeavoring to locate in himself, you know, a pure unmediated thought. And words are something that are part of a cultural and social construct. Yet he uses words, uses the device of a manifesto to express probably his most profound theories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this one on the theater of cruelty. So there's that, which is kind of ironic in a way. But then again, you know, what choice do you have, I guess? But this was a guy, again, a lot of his writing had to do with his inability to articulate the purity of what's in his head using the words that have been given him. So there's that. Okay, but regarding the theater of cruelty, this is one of the ideas that's often very misrepresented by people. It's not about portraying cruelty on the stage. It's not about a bloodlust or violence on that. That's not what he meant by cruelty. What he meant by cruelty is basically destabilizing people's perceptions, their presuppositions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to him what the theater of cruelty was really all about.
So how does cruelty take shape or form in the work? What does it look like as a performance to experience? And yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, for example, there was his adaptation of Le Cenci, which was, you know, it's an old story, but it's, he was taking basically Percy Shelley's adaptation of it. And it was the themes that it dealt with, incest, amongst other things, for example, that he was calculating would be very disturbing to the audience. It was disturbing only to the extent that it was apparently a really, really bad performance. It was a really, really bad play that he had written, and it got terrible reviews.
Hmm.
But at the time, it was scandalous. And I think that was what he was endeavoring to do, was to create scandal, to have an audience. And this is what he meant by cruelty, is that to wake people out of their complacency and lethargy by dealing with themes and subjects, not cruelty, as I said, in terms of violence, but some sort of a visceral reaction that people would have, and that when they would leave the space of the theater, they would be totally transformed from how they had been before. And that's what he means as cruelty, that people go through life seeking comfort, seeking pleasure, seeking reaffirmation. And that when they see one of his plays, when they see a play that when they see a piece that follows this theater of cruelty, they'll come out completely transformed and different and questioning and challenging that which they believed and that which they found so comforting in the past.
And as I understand it, David, the notion of cruelty in theater circled back in his work to the influence and his impressions of non-Western ritual and performance in some of the context that he, you know, admired.
Yeah, he did. You're referring specifically, I think, to the Balinese theater that
That's
he experienced
right. Yeah,
in 1931. Yeah, and again, it wasn't violence in that. It was these very, very long dance performances. And what he felt was actually, and this was part of what he meant by cruelty, was returning back to the primal.
Hmm.
In some respects, it was a rejection of civilization as we know it, in terms of Western civilization, in terms of things that are more refined, that are overproduced. And that's what he was endeavoring to do. That's what he saw, at least from his own perspective in the Balinese theater. Here's the ironic thing, is he felt what the Balinese were doing was some sort of a timeless dance where the dancers appeared to be, I think he called them living hieroglyphics. So what he felt he saw was something that had been performed, you know, for centuries and centuries and passed down from each generation completely unaltered. That's not what he was actually seeing. What he saw at that colonial exposition was actually a dance that was a relatively recent vintage. And I don't mean relatively, I mean, it was only a dance that was like only 10, 20 years old. But in his eyes, it was so different from the West, from anything that he saw in the West, that he felt it had to have been something that was unmediated from what had originally been produced centuries before.
When you are talking about sort of the end of Otto's life and his death, you raise this issue around the specifics of his death and his burial, of the tension between his friends and family at the end of his life, but then throughout his life. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, one thing I haven't discussed was religion. And Otto had a very up and down, ebb and flow relationship with religion. You know, as a kid, he became very religious at one point, talked about becoming a priest. Mm-hmm. Then he rejected all that in the 1920s. And then he comes back from Mexico and he goes to Ireland and he suddenly becomes extremely Catholic. And, you know, this is, of course, the worst time of his life mentally. This is when he's really going through a big time breakdown, as he's tramping through Ireland and, you know, causing all sorts of problems when he's there. And he was like that in the various asylums that he was in until he went to Rodez. Then when he goes to Rodez, he goes through the electric shock treatments and he writes some things that are, you know, were very condemnatory of religion, Christianity in particular. And what he's saying is that he, you know, he has no use for religion and all that. So his mother, though, was a very strong Catholic. And he remained very close to his mom. Now, when he died, the circle of people that were around him when he was released from Rodez, the circle of people in Paris, they understood that he was someone who was very conflicted about religion. Well, no longer conflicted, I should say. He was somebody who really had rejected whatever kind of affirmations of religion he had expressed in the past. His family, on the other hand, wanted to have a religious burial. And ultimately, his friends won out on this one. And it was not, but it created real tension between his family and the circle of artists who were around him at the end. Mm-hmm. And then this would lead to what I think is kind of a funny story that Serge related to me about his ultimate burial down in Marseille. So when he was released from Rodez, he goes back to Paris, and just outside of Paris, he's at the, I guess it's kind of an asylum that used to exist at Ivry-sur-Seine, you know, mm-hmm. just outside of Paris. And he was there and treated pretty well when he was there. They let him, you know, indulge in drugs because, you know, they knew that that's what he craved and he wasn't going to probably live a long time. And, you know, so they were indulgent of that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he dies there, dies of an overdose. He had been diagnosed with stomach cancer and he was prescribed narcotics, prescribed opiates, and he was pretty careful to take the prescribed dosage, but he was found one morning by the gardener of the asylum, and he was, you know, at the foot of his bed, basically, and the vial was empty. I don't know if he did this intentionally, if he was ready to check out, or whether, you know, it was just an accidental overdose, but I mean, he was kind of heading in that direction. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he dies, he's buried and all that, and he's buried at Ivry-sur-Seine. And then his family, years later, decided that they wanted to move him to Nice, or to Marseille, excuse me, where he's from and where the family plot was. And I talk about this in the book, but what it was at that time was, I think it was his mother was there, no, his sister was there, excuse me, and Serge, his nephew, and Serge's sister was also there. And so Otto was dug up, and all they found were bones, and because Serge's car was too small, they had to put the bones in a little box, basically, which was basically a casket for children. They drove down to Marseille, and the cemetery where he's to be buried was closed for the night, so they stayed in a really dodgy part of Marseille. I don't know why, but they stayed in some dodgy part, and they were super scared that somebody was going to steal the car with the precious box of bones in it. Uh-huh. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But so what the family did was the family kept vigil the entire night, watching the car and making sure that nobody didn't steal the car and then get Otto's bones. But anyway, they had a ceremony for him. It was a religious ceremony for Otto. I don't know how he would react to it. Again, I don't want to cast judgments on the family's interpretation of his life versus those of his friends. Mm-hmm. I was just writing exactly what happened, you know, in the book.
Mm-hmm. I really admire how you work with this, you know, pretty crazy story without turning the book into a true, well, not a true crime, but a like the sensational tale, because it has all of these aspects in it, you know, from the two grandmothers who are related right to the end of this, these stories about, you know, just even how his body is handled. So let's talk about the sort of in the epilogue to the book, you talk about Aalto's relationship to posterity and all of the different types of movements in, you know, cultural theory, art, theater, music, from performance to punk, the influences that Aalto's life and work have had on some of these other movements. So what are some of the things that really stand out for you in terms of the legacy that Aalto leaves for the world of art and culture?
I think that his greatest legacies are to, is, well, I think would be to theater. Mm-hmm. The most obvious one would be people like Peter Brook, for example, mm-hmm. you know, I write about, who, you know, directly references Aalto. There were other people as well in theater who, who used his work. There was Jerzy Kotowski, for example, amongst others. There was the Living Theater in Chicago. There was, who was it? What was his name? Reza Abdo, late Reza mm-hmm. Abdo. And I don't know if you've ever seen any of his plays, but there are things that to many audiences are kind of incomprehensible. And I once saw a Reza Abdo play. He passed away from AIDS several years ago, but I saw one of his plays in Los Angeles, and I've never seen more people walk out of a performance. Wow. Now, this is before I ever worked on Aalto. And then, of course, when I started working on Aalto, I saw some, you know, I referenced back to that play that I'd seen of Abdo. And then, of course, I read that, you know, there is this connection between Abdo and Aalto. So in terms of theater, again, destabilizing elements, that's what you see in, you know, the Marassa that, mm-hmm. you know, that Peter Brook produced, or directed, I should say. In terms of other people, well, there were some that I referenced, for example, in, who was it? The Japanese dance, form known as Buto. Mm-hmm. I wrote about that now, and I owe a debt actually to the artist Richard Hawkins, who's one of my neighbors in Silver Lake District of Los Angeles. Huh. Who's Richard is working on an Aalto piece at the moment. He's doing something on Aalto's experiences in Mexico, and I think he was doing some research, and he found out before my book came out that I was writing this book, and then he said to me, "If you're ever in Los Angeles, let's get together." And I told him I live in Los Angeles. It turns out we live about a mile apart, so I owe him that. But punk was something that. It's pretty important to me because it was something that I was into and still am into. You know, there's the anarchic spirit of punk, I think, is something that's very prevalent in Aalto, for example. And then, of course, there are the people like Richard Hell and the Voidoids. And, of course, he was in the band Television, at least in its mm-hmm. initial incarnation. And Patti Smith, who have directly written about Aalto and, you know, how they were taken by him. And, you know, even if you can't see these kind of direct parallels, the fact that they reference him is pretty important. But again, I mean, I think we see a lot of these, we try to look too closely, and when we don't see the connection, then we have to make some inferential leaps. And I don't think that the inferential leaps are too big between Aalto's spirit of punk and his rejection of bourgeois values and really the same ethos that we see in punk.
So David, the book has been out, I don't know how long, for 5 or 6 months? Is that when it came
out? Yeah, something like that. I think it came out in April.
I have a couple of questions about that. So mm-hmm. What does Serge think of what you've had to say about Aalto if he's read it? And yeah, what type of response are you getting to, you know, from either from other folks who've worked on Aalto, or will it come out in translation, you think? What's the afterlife of the book been since its publication?
Yeah, so Serge, Serge knows very little English for a start, mm-hmm. so there's mm-hmm. that. So that's somewhat problematic for him. But he said that he had a friend translate part of it, and Serge now lives most of the year in Paris. Right. But last time I saw him was about, I think it was right after the book came out, and I gave him a copy of it and inscribed it for him. And you know, and then he wrote to me later, or his wife Simone did, and said that they had a friend who read some of it, and they thought, oh, this was really, really good. Now, he might have just been saying that. I don't know. I really don't know, because I don't think that there's that much that a friend was able to translate for him. So that's unfortunate that Serge is not going to be able to really read the whole book. And I guess it's unfortunate. Maybe it is fortunate. I don't know how he would react to the whole thing, but again, I tried not to be judgmental and of Artaud, and I hope he would appreciate that.
Yeah.
With regard to the book's afterlife, so far, in terms of reviews, I haven't seen any reviews thus far. So I don't know what the reception has been in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to other Artaud scholars, I haven't heard from any of them. So again, I don't know if it's too new, the book, or too inconsequential, or or what it is, really.
Well, there's lots of time. It just came out.
There is time, yeah. And in terms of a translation, I don't even know if that's going to happen because, you know, there's been so much written about him in France. I think that I add something new to the Artaud story,
mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of my contextualization, but there have been some really good biographies of him, you know, that I could mention, that are not in translation, that could have been, but in terms of it for an English language work for an Anglophone audience, there hasn't been a lot written about Artaud, recently. Okay. There have been a few things that have come out in the last 5 years, but that's been about it, you know, in terms of books.
So David, you raised this a bit earlier, this new work that you're doing, and I just wanted to come back to that and just wanted to ask if you wanted to say any more, if you could tell us any more about the project that you're doing on this murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. In writing the Artaud book, one thing I really wanted to do was have fun with the book, with my subject. I wanted to write something that was enjoyable. I wanted to write something that was readable.
Yeah.
That was going to appeal to various audiences, not just a scholarly audience, for example, but something that would have a larger appeal. I think as scholars, we do our research a disservice when we only write for our peers.
Right.
And so that's what I was hoping to avoid with the Artaud book. With respect to this new work that I'm doing on Germaine Berton, this murder case, first of all, I'm really surprised that nobody's done any work on it because it's actually quite a fascinating story. This young woman who you know is in Paris and is in these various circles, and you know she kills this guy Marius Plateau because she wants to avenge a few things. First of all, she wants to avenge the you know the French militarism in the Ruhr after World War I, for example. That's one thing, for example. Second thing was the murder of Jean Jaurès on the eve of the First World War. Her father had always said that, you know, this was terrible, that this would have kept France out of the war and so on and so forth. And so politically, she had been, you know, really influenced by her dad. So she kills this guy. There's a trial. She was caught, you know, literally, you know, with the smoking gun. Mm-hmm. And, she's found not guilty. And it was kind of a tit for tat for the guy who killed Jaurès, whose name escapes me at the moment, where he served very little time in prison, if I'm not mistaken, if he served any time. And she was found not guilty. And, you know, she resumed her political activities for a bit. And then she ultimately, you know, kind of went underground for a bit and then committed suicide during the Second World War. So, again, as a murder case, I want to have a little bit of fun with that. And I don't know, I'm dealing with, you know, thinking of different strategies for how to work on that case. I've been working on the research at the Archives de la Préfecture de la Police, you know, so I've been doing that and going through the police reports and so on and so forth, their investigation and kind of approaching it from that end. Kind of thought about giving it kind of a Rashomon type treatment where I'm looking at it from different perspectives, the case. So I'm doing that. I'm also working on another project on the construction of the French teenager in the 1950s and early 1960s through magazines and newspapers and so on and so forth.
Well, that all sounds really, really exciting. And I hope you'll come back and talk to me about that murder case when it's out in new book form. And yeah, I just wanted to note that I think this book was a lot of fun to read. So success on that front.
Well, thank you.
So, David, thanks so much for joining me and for writing the book.
Thank you very much.